In the last movement of Brahms's double concerto, the soloists were father and son, Jan Pascal and Paul Tortelier, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Well, I hope you can join me tomorrow when the final year I'll be looking at is 1893, and we'll be hearing the Alto Rhapsody, as well as from the Clarinet Quintet and the German Requiem.
And Donald will be back with that programme at 6 o'clock tomorrow evening. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 7 o'clock. Time now to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom, which is presented by Katie Derham.
Good evening and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra are here for the third time this prom season. And tonight, they're playing under their principal guest conductor, Ilan Volkov. It's a programme of two Austrian works composed over 130 years apart. One is Bruckner's mighty, soul-searching Fifth Symphony, something of a speciality of Maestro Volkov. The other is, in fact, a world premiere and BBC commission, Thomas Lacher's Concerto for Violin, Cello and Orchestra, starring husband and wife Matthew Barley and Victoria Mullova. The Lacher Concerto is opening the concert tonight, and Victoria and Matthew aren't the only soloists on stage. Composer Thomas Lacher is also a highly renowned pianist, and he'll be joining them playing a prepared piano as part of what he calls a concertino, a group of semi-soloists, which he's added to the musical mix for this work. Apart from his prepared piano in this concertino is an electric zither, an accordion and percussion, and this helps create a whole new sound. Now, the concerto is something that Thomas Lacher has written since meeting cellist Matthew Barley, who, as I'm sure many of you know, is fascinated by A, improvisation, and B, bringing the worlds of classical and jazz together. So, though the work is very much Thomas's, there's also no question it's been a highly collaborative process between the two musicians. Well, earlier I was talking to the two of them about the work, and I started by asking Thomas what had inspired him.
I played in Albert Hall once, this was some 3 years ago, I think, also together with Matthew. I was the first one to enter the stage. It drew me into it, you know, and this was an inspiration for the whole piece, actually, to come on the stage. No one in the whole hall and everything empty and just all the pictures which come up in your head when you're in such a space.
Tell us about the concerto.
Well, the concerto emerged through an idea of Matthew. He wanted to have a piece, and there had been many stages of developing the project as such, but also their wish to have something which would go a little bit beyond the conventional double concerto. In the end, I came up with the idea of having the concertino, which is now in the end bound into the score quite strictly, but still gives another layer, another world, which appears at the back of the orchestra.
So, Matthew, how is that for you as one of the soloists to work with an orchestra, but also with this, as Thomas was saying, another layer of musicians?
Well, it's wonderful. I mean, one of the most exciting things for me, as you know, I'm an improviser, is that some of their parts are not notated. So we hear slightly different things, you know, each time we go through a passage, and I absolutely love that sort of openness in it. Some of the sound effects, some of the actual, you know, noises that come out of those instruments are incredible. You know, they're colours that, you know, some do come from the electronic zither and some from acoustic instruments. But it's one of the things that I enjoy most is that on the one hand, I can hear, and I don't know if Thomas will thank me for this, but I can hear a kind of Austrian Viennese tradition that goes back a long way, yet with these most extraordinary 21st century sounds. And a lot of that comes from the concertino group.
So the concerto is in two movements, and you can hear some applause there for the leader, Laura Samuel, who's just coming onto the stage now, leader of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. Let's talk about those two movements, though. The first is full of complex rhythms, and the second very calm and slow. And Thomas told me that was actually really challenging for him to write because he considers himself an extremely hyper composer. Oh, and for those of you wondering about the prepared piano, well, apparently Thomas has changed the sound by using gaffer tape and rubber wedges. By the by, if you would like to read some programme notes, you can go to the BBC Proms website. Well, here come to the stage soloist Victoria Mullova, violinist and cellist Matthew Barley, with conductor Ilan Volkov, to perform Thomas Lacher's Concerto for Violin, Cello and Orchestra. The concertino group already on the stage. Thomas Lacher's there at his piano with Martin Bandelmeier, Luca Juhart and Christoph Dietz. world premiere performance there of Thomas Larker's Concerto for Violin, Cello and Orchestra. The composer who'd been playing the piano in his concertino group on stage, taking a bow and a hug from conductor Ilan Volkov, who conducted the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. And creating that magical, extraordinary sound world, I should just mention the other members of the concertino. They are on the electric zither, Christoph Dienz, on the accordion, Luca Juhart, and on percussion, Martin Vandelmeier. Soloists Matthew Barley and Victoria Mulova going off stage now. You know, they're an extraordinary couple, both as at home with core classical repertoire as they are with this sort of experimental contemporary classical repertoire. They both adore fusion, they both adore jazz and world music. Very talented pair, both individually and playing together. And as they come back to the stage with Thomas Larker, who's a friend of theirs too, to take another bow, I should mention that Matthew and Victoria will be back at 10:15 for a late night prom of gypsy music from their recent Peasant Girl project. They'll be joined by a group of their musician mates, including pianist Julian Joseph. Matthew, as we heard in the interview earlier, the great improviser, and he and Thomas, when they were chatting to me before tonight's prom, said they hadn't quite cracked the improvisational aspect of their work together, so they would be, I quote, having another batch. Back on stage for their third bow, Victoria Mulova and Matthew Barley. The modest composer Thomas Larker hanging back, but encouraged out with conductor Ilan Volkov as well. The world premiere of Larker's Concerto for Violin, Cello and Orchestra. Well, as they leave the stage, as the applause continues for that extraordinary work, it is time for the interval now. We've got Bruckner 5 in the second half, so do stay tuned for that. But now, as it's the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra prom, we thought we'd stay north of the border for our interval. And Rachel Kinley, who is an experienced wild swimmer, who normally swims in the River Avon, a quiet and gentle place to take a dip, but she's gone to the Isle of Skye, where local wild swimmers take her to experience something rather different. Freshwater limestone pools set amid some of Skye's most awe-inspiring scenery.
I'm Dave, and I live on Skye. I live in Kilmuir, or a place called Linacrow, which is right up in the north end of Skye, looking out across towards the Western Isles, and I love wild swimming.
Nestled in the Coolin Hills is a secluded spot where local wild swimmer Dave Morton is going to take me for a dip.
We've got the river snaking up, snaking ahead of us, the stony grey riverbed in between the green heathery moorlands, snaking up the valley, up the glen, and then there's this sort of amazing ridge up on the skyline. Gentle at first, gentle round ridge, and then really craggy over there in the distance. And you can't see where we're going. It's tucked away, hidden away, the secret world that we're going to go to. It's amazing, actually, because you just can't see it at all.
Wow, so it's just beyond that spur there, is it? Beneath the ridge, hidden in the basin?
Yeah, it's just hidden. Yeah, it's not far at all either. It's probably going to be 5 minutes and we'll be there.
Oh, that's intriguing.
My name's Kevin Donnelly. I work in the Gaelic College here, Solmore Ostig, which is 3 miles along the road. This loch is called Loch na Dúrachan. Dú is Gaelic for black, as in ski and dú, the black knife, and you which you wear with the kilt. And Dúrach is shadow, black. And Dúrachan is the shadows, and it's called Lochan and Dúrachan because the hills are steep on this side and steeper on the far side. So it'd be good for shadows for fishermen. I think fishermen like to be fishing in the shadows where the fish won't see them. 25 metres deep, 83 feet deep, a fisherman told me. And it's supposed to have a water horse, but I've never seen it. This is the 11th swim this summer. And it's very handy. I just get, when I feel the urge, when I get tired of the computing, I just come up the road and come in and have a quick swim and then go back to work again. When we go in here, not warm as you see. It seems okay at first, you've got a solid bottom, but when you get to the edge of these rushes, it just plunges down.
Yeah. The well, water's amazing gobble colour, isn't it, here, when you look down at your feet?
It's a bit peaty, yeah. One, two, three. Right, well, we swim along the shore here.
Yeah.
It's cold, but tolerable. You have to keep swimming, and you use up a lot of energy, so you can't keep it up for more than about 20 or 25 minutes.
It's so beautiful here, Kevin, isn't
it? You didn't...
It? With the hillside and the bracken and the heather rising up straight out of the loch.
Ah, it's good.
So everybody knows about the water horse. A neighbour said that when he's old enough to have gone by here on horses and with horses and carts and things, and he said the horses used to smell it and rear up when they came nearby. But this loch is quite famous because they actually dredged it to try and get the water horse in 1870 or 1871. They put a net right across and people on each bank and dragged the whole loch, but they didn't get the water horse, so it's still there. I think some people said it's like a big cow or a horse.
It's good to have company.
How are you feeling now? Are you a little chilly or are you kind of feeling ready
well, we'll
to
see you.
On the well?
If I get dry quickly, that's the main thing. You have to keep swimming till you get to the rushes. You can swim, you have a few strokes into the rushes. And there are a few stones around here. So you get to know it.
Last year, me and a couple of friends did a wonderful swim across Loch Maree. You know, that's a particularly, you know, I suppose that's a favourite swim that I did. Loch Maree's a big loch further north near Gairloch, that has these beautiful wooded islands on it, a whole string of islands with ancient Scots pine on them because, you know, they haven't been grazed or anything. And a friend and I, well, two friends and I, one had a canoe and the other two of us swam, and we swam between the islands, which was just, that was amazing. So to strike out across the loch and then get to a little wooded island, have a little rest and then swim off to the next island, it was just fantastic.
Gosh, you can have real adventures during the time. Explore places that you wouldn't get to normally.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, and great to do it completely under your own steam.
Yeah, that's what I love about it, is the perspective that you get on the world is unlike what you'd get if you were walking through it or driving through it. You're suddenly like lower down in these gorges looking up and you wouldn't normally be there. And like you say, kind of swimming across the islands that people can't get to normally.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really special.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. And I just think as you're saying that pattern, especially if you're doing front crawl and you've got your face, so you're looking down in the water into this sort of brown, peaty water, and then looking up at the sky and across to the land on the other side. Yeah, this sort of funny rhythm, this looking in and out. It's amazing.
And the wildlife you come across sometimes, there's a lot of, where I swim quite often in the River Avon, you've got damselflies and you've got dragonflies just floating above the water surface, and water boatmen skimming past alongside you.
Well, we just the other day when we were swimming in the pool near our house, we spotted an orchid that was just growing up on the sort of little rocky cliff face. So I think that's the thing, quite often it's the plants actually and the flowers, and you're sort of down in the green and all the colours around you. And we see dippers sometimes, and lots of fish in the in the pools, trout, often see trout. And I was swimming in the River Tweed last Saturday, and the person swimming next to me saw a huge eel swimming towards him.
At the moment on our walk to these pools, we're walking between some of the vast hills that are on Skye, the craggy mountain tops with just a little bit of cloud on the peaks of them. And they're really quite imposing. It's kind of getting towards evening now. It's getting towards about 8 p.m. And then I think we're heading onto an old riverbed, are we?
Yeah. Well, the river reappears. This is because the river sunk underneath this bit. But we'll start to see the river in a minute. You know, lots of good places to swimming on Skye, but quite a lot of them are very peaty. Although around the Coolin, the water's very clear as well, beautifully clear. One of the things that's really exciting about doing the wild swimming is finding your own places as well. And like these pools, which are really special, are there to be discovered, you know, they're there. And I guess lots of people, because quite a few people will walk up into the hills this way, must just come across them by chance, which will be amazing. You'll see when we see them, because they're just so striking.
Would you say that you were one of the wild swimming kings of Skye?
Definitely not. But it is something that I've got a bit obsessed with, as I think people do, who do a lot of wild swimming. I think it's quite addictive, because it just makes you feel so good, actually, after you've done it. I think there are lots of reasons for that. I think there's probably real sort of physiological reasons that the cold water sort of releases endorphins and you get a sort of quite a buzz from swimming. But also I think it does, you can, whenever you have a swim after it, you feel different. The day always changes, and nearly always, if not always, in a positive way. And it sort of sounds a bit corny, but it does definitely make you feel, it sort of grounds you somehow, I think, and connects you with something bigger. And you love swimming as well, don't you, Annie?
Yeah.
Yeah, we do lots of swimming together. This is Anna. You should say who you are.
I'm Anna.
And how old are you?
Eight.
One of the things that really inspired me was Roger Deakin's book, Waterlog. In fact, because of that, we went on a holiday. He talks about swimming in these old slate quarries on the west coast of Scotland, Isle of Sale. And we had a lovely holiday there and went to these, not the quarries that he goes to quarries on a separate island, but they're very similar, these quite nearby. These amazing crystal clear water, very, very deep, those sort of 400 feet deep.
Why is it that you go wild swimming? Does it help you de-stress from the world?
I mean, I think that can certainly be something that it does do. I have a great job, actually. I work with children and young people who are having a difficult time, experiencing mental health difficulties, which is a lovely job to do, and it gets me travelling around in this lovely place. But it can be quite, it can be quite stressful, talking to people about things that they're finding difficult. And it's lovely here because there are lots of little spots that you can stop off on the way home and have a swim. And I think that, one of the great things about swimming is that it does, it sort of changes everything after you've had a dip. Everything feels different, so it's a good way of changing the day.
I'm Chrissy Gillis. I'm from the Isle of Rasay and I've just grown up around water. So just going in for a swim and going in for a float or even a paddle in the middle of winter, it wakens you up. The water is so clear. It's one of the wonderful things about being in the west coast of Scotland is the quality of the water. It's why you get divers coming from all over the world to go diving off Uist and Lewist and off Skye.
When you can see the little glen that we're walking up, snaking round ahead of us. Still no sign of the really exciting pools, which are just around the corner. In fact, you can just see the treetops now. Can you just see a little feathery?
Oh, yeah, just peeking out. Yeah. Giving us a glimpse of what there is to come around the corner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it is, we're really walking up into the heart of the mountains, aren't we? It looks like you're going to kind of a place that's surrounded on three sides by the mountains and kind of sheltered up there with this view out towards the sea and towards the coast beyond.
I always think it's quite exciting just here because you've still got no idea quite what's there. And it's only just a little, it's a little area, but it's very, very, you can't get a sense of what it's going to be like yet.
You've got a complete grin across your face. You're really, really excited about where we're going to go and what we're going to see. We've just come around the corner and just reviewed the pool. And it's incredibly vivid green water, really. It looks like it could be anywhere tropical. And there's water descending down some limestone into the plunge pool below. Little trees hanging over the top. In the middle of a gully, so it feels like it's sheltered from all sides. And there's like an idyllic spot that you can just creep down into and have a dive. Down you go. You got it?
Yeah.
So we're here. It's really exciting as well being here at this time of the day, because we'd never normally be here at this time of day. And it looks so inviting. Do you think it looks inviting?
Oh, definitely. Clear water, crystal clear, with the waterfall running down in there. It feels like some special spa retreat. That's like a special deep plunge pool.
No, Anna was telling me about it, because the kids spent ages playing in there last time we were down.
Amazing.
So now we go into the little exciting gorge to see the trees at the top.
Do you want to lead the way?
Shall I?
Yeah, please.
Make me feel like an explorer.
The Fairy Pools are absolutely amazing. The tunnels, the way some bits are more open and you can just see the cliffs and you can see the coolings in the background. And then there's other ones, you can see the bottom and you can see all the stones. And the stones are all so smooth and so round at the bottom from years of just being churned around in these bottom of these, like, they look like cauldrons. And it's just, it's absolutely beautiful.
At the moment, following up the stream along the rocks, and they're quite slippy underfoot, there's a lot of weed on here. So taking care to take our steps as we follow up to the main pool at the top where apparently we're going to encounter a waterfall. I think it's supposed to be the most special part here, with a little cave underneath it.
As we get closer, this is the last little bit, just that we can't see, we're just around the corner is where it is. I feel the adrenaline starting to build up a little bit every time I come. It's really exciting. So I'm going to leave my stuff here, I think. You see, that's where we're going to swim in.
I did not expect this to be up here when we came on the corner. What we can see now is a really small gully that we're about to weave our way through. And at the end, probably about 10 metres away from us, I can just see the bottom of a waterfall crashing down into turquoise water. And surrounding it on above are loads of ferns hanging down and kind of fallen tree trunks around that are twisted and knotted. And there's a couple of foxgloves as well. So you really feel like you're inside some kind of magical, like, gully that's taking you in there to tempt you into swim.
As we go in, you'll see the rocks with an amazing shape. There's a bit you can stand on just once you get in around the corner. It's very deep on the right. It's about, I don't know, 10 or 15 feet deep. But the rocks, amazing sculpted rocks when we get in there with the waterfall. I mean, above the right is the waterfall.
So how did you feel when you first came here yourself?
It was a bit creepy, actually, just on my own, because I didn't really know what was in there. And the other thing is I had a mask on, which is great, but it's amazing how deep it is. And there's a bit of a seam of black rock at the bottom that makes it seem deeper than it is. It sort of looks like it goes down forever until you realise it's just black rock.
It's the bottomless pool beneath you. How deep would you say it was down there?
I don't know. I think it's probably about 10, 15 feet deep.
Okay, see you through there. So we're about to go and swim through the little gully first so we can reach the pool right down there. See you soon.
See ya. Have you got my nanny? Cold. Do you want to go on my back or do you want to just go?
I don't want to go on your back.
Okay, hold on then. Oh, beautiful. That's amazing. You're right down below. You've got lots of trees up above you, so you're looking up through the green trees, and you've got the water pouring down on your head. And the way the rock sort of slants, you have to work your way through this crack, so you sort of feel like you're right in the middle of it all. Yeah, right in the landscape somehow. I think I always feel better after I've got out. I think there's probably a real sort of physical part to that. You know, I think it probably releases sort of endorphins and physically makes your body feel better. It puts things into perspective somehow.
The waterfall's got so much power behind it that it falls down on your head, and you can see exactly what you were saying before, that it's carved this incredibly deep channel beneath, and we just have to dive down for it, and it's probably 20 foot deep down there, and so it's phenomenal.
Maybe we should go and try the other pool. So we just think we'll have a quick bit before I... Do you want to go first?
There's nothing better that I love more than looking up and looking through the leaves of trees when you're down the water.
Yeah, yeah.
You wouldn't get to be in this place normally. You don't usually kind of look up through trees.
No,
being
no.
in the river, because they grow, you're down and they're growing over you so that there's able to be kind of light, the light space below that they're growing into. So when you look up.
Yeah, no, no, it's really pretty, isn't it? That, I'm just thinking as we're talking, it's very much. You feel like you're part of, you're sort of sunken into the, really part of the land, aren't you? Part of the rocks and the...
Exactly, dug down deep, like 20 metres below the surface where everyone else is walking. We're down this little crevice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's
secret spot, really, isn't it? We're still on top now, some white limestone, which the water's slowly going along and it's descending down into a turquoise pool at the base. And the turquoise pool looks like it's really quite deep. It's probably about 7 foot down there as the water descends into it. And that's where we're about to take our next dip.
You know, Dad particularly was really into swimming, and his granddad, I know, used to, and there was a joke about it, but he used to swim all year round, and when they were kids, he'd made a plunge pool in their garden, and they always used to talk about him breaking the ice in the winter to go in the plunge pool. And we used to live in Cambridge, and he used to swim in the River Cam all year round. So I feel, you know, I do sometimes think about that connection with him. But it's just such a lovely thing to do. You know, and you get sort of addicted to doing it. And it's lovely that Anna enjoys it so much as well. I mean, Grace, my other daughter as well, is really keen. It's just a lovely thing to do.
It's a real family affair,
yeah.
Here, like, taking the kids swimming.
Yeah. We quite often go together, don't we, after...
I come home from school.
I remember last year as well, a couple of times getting home and Anna was sitting with a wetsuit on waiting for me when I got there, saying, can we go to the river?
Like intrepid explorers,
yeah.
Forging your own way across sky together.
Definitely.
Your dad found that one. He found the waterfall up at the top, which was wonderful. So he must be good tracking them down.
That was Wild Swimming, and it was presented by Rachel Kinley and produced by Kate Bissell. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall, live here on BBC Radio 3 with me, Katie Derham. We're now going to hear a simply monumental work, Bruckner's Fifth Symphony, played by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and conducted by their principal guest conductor, Ilan Volkov, who is something of a Bruckner fan. The symphony is sometimes called the Tragic or the Church of Faith, but don't despair, it has one of the most life-affirming finales you will ever hear. Bruckner wrote the piece at a particularly miserable time in his life. He'd moved to Vienna in his 40s, a talented composer, a wonderful organist, who knew that his comfortable, easy life in the small town of Linz had long since stopped providing a challenge. So he headed to the city of his dreams, the city of Mozart, of Schubert, of Beethoven, expecting to find inspiration, intelligent appreciation, and applause. Instead, he spent 10 years impoverished, unappreciated, his music at best ignored, at worst reviled. He was hardly making any money, and though he was delighted to earn the praise and friendship of one of his heroes, Wagner, that association made him even more unpopular with certain sections of the press, who were absolutely vile to him. Still, it was at this time that he wrote some of his most sublime music. Quietly, doggedly, he produced four extraordinary symphonies between 1871 and 1876, working on structure and form, returning to similar themes but always finding new character. His fifth, which we're hearing tonight, is one which should be savoured, as one critic put it, like musical slow food. Here's conductor Ilan Volkov with his thoughts on this massive work.
What I think is very interesting in this music, that it's not only about spirituality, which is always, you know, what's being talked about. It has also a lot of really folkloristic elements, a lot of really dramatic moments, which come almost from opera. You can hear really the influence of Wagner in this music. And so it's not only about this. If it was only this, this would be quite boring, I think. It's more about the contrasts that are there that's important, but also, of course, about this kind of very important distillation, I mean, the fragmentation in this piece especially. I mean, there's almost no material. The material is very condensed, much more than any other previous symphony of his. So this is really the most modernistic from his early symphonies, and it really leads the way to the Ninth Symphony and the Eighth. I kind of find it less interesting to talk about the spirituality in it, because I just feel that this is quite hard to translate into words exactly what it is. There are elements, of course, that you can put your finger very clearly, but it's more about the general attitude and acceptance of life and God very much into his music and into his life. You can really sense that.
So we have four movements. Numbers 1, 2, and 4 start with pizzicato strings, and this symphony is sometimes called the Pizzicato Symphony. It starts very slowly with an adagio that picks up pace to an allegro. The second movement is unambiguously slow in tempo, and it's rather sad. Then a scherzo follows, and then a glorious finale. Well, the stage has filled up considerably since the first half of tonight's prom. We've now got banks of brass ready and waiting. And I should just mention, it's a very special day for flautist Rosemary Locke, who's celebrating 25 years with the orchestra today. Well, as we await tonight's conductor, Ilan Volkov, I could just add that he was chief conductor of this orchestra between 2003 and 2009. And through the orchestra, he championed many new works. Now he comes on, though, to conduct one of his favourites, Bruckner's Fifth Symphony, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra with Ilan Volkov.
Thank you.
The life-affirming finale to Bruckner's Fifth Symphony, performed there with great passion and vigour by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra under their principal guest conductor, Ilan Volkov. Who's returning to the stage to bring the orchestra to their feet once again. Paying particular attention to the wind players. Now bringing the brass to their feet. Great cheers here. This is a piece, you know, that wasn't performed at the Proms until 1964 when Charles Groves conducted it. And the great Brucknerians, if that's the word, followed suit. Heiting, Bernard Heiting, who's here tomorrow conducting Brahms. Two Brahms Proms coming up in the next couple of days under him. Then there was Gunter Vans and Claudio Abbado, of course. And until tonight, the most recent performance was in 2003, when the BBC Symphony Orchestra performed it under Jukka Pekka Saraselt. Ilan Volkov, still applauding his orchestra, the orchestra of which he was chief conductor for 6 years. He's now about to take up a new position as music director and chief conductor of the Iceland Symphony Orchestra. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, meanwhile, having a very busy summer. They're off the Edinburgh International Festival in the next week or so. Mahler's Second Symphony. They've got the Scottish premiere of James McMillan's St John Passion. Lots of great stuff. Wonderful performance by them this evening. But as the applause continues, that's it for tonight's prom. Do come back, though, at 10:15. Victoria Mulliver and Matthew Barley will be back with their programme of Hungarian, Gypsy and jazz music. And this time tomorrow, as I said, it's the first of the two proms dedicated to Brahms with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe conducted by legendary Bernard Haitink. So do tune in for that. But now it's time to hand you back to Broadcasting House and Jill Anderson.
Thank you very much. That was Katie Derham at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on Radio 3. If you can't make that, then it'll be available on the BBC iPlayer for the next 7 days. Well, in about 17 minutes, that's at 9:30, we'll be hearing more about the composer of tonight's new concerto, Thomas Lacher. He'll be talking to Andrew McGregor in our Proms Composer Portrait. But first, more music by Anton Bruckner, but this time for voices. Bruckner was a committed Roman Catholic and wrote some of the finest liturgical music of the time for that church. We're going to hear Locus Iste, composed in 1869 for the new Linz Cathedral. Os Justi Meditabitur, a setting of Psalm 37, the mouth of the just is exercised in wisdom, and Christus Factus Est Pro Nobis, Christ for us became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Here are the Corydon Singers, conducted by Matthew Best.
Thank you.
three graduals by Bruckner, Locus Iste, Os Justi Meditabitur and Christus Factus Est. They were sung by the Corydon Singers, conducted by Matthew Best. And to end this sequence of Bruckner's motets, here is Ave Maria. Anton Bruckner's setting of Ave Maria. It was sung by the Corydon Singers, conducted by Matthew Best. This is Radio 3, it's 9:30 and time for our Proms composer portrait. This was recorded earlier this evening and it's introduced by Andrew McGregor.
Welcome to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall of the Royal College of Music, just a stone's throw from the Royal Albert Hall, where the world premiere of Thomas Lacher's new double concerto is one of the highlights of this evening's first prom. And Thomas will be telling us more about his music and the way he composes in just a moment. And we'll be hearing three pieces by him performed by young musicians from the Royal College of Music. A movement from his Sonata for Solo Cello, the Antennen Requiem for prepared piano, and his piano trio Kraken. Now, Thomas Lacher, at first glance, the worlds of a solo cello sonata and a double concerto with orchestra sound like just completely different sound worlds, and yet I do know that you say you like to compose for very specific musicians, that the musicians who are playing the pieces, the first performers, are what inspires a lot of your music.
Right, yeah. So the cello sonata, we'll only hear the last movement of it, was written for Natalie Klein. And so this evening's double concerto is, of course, written for Rika Mulova and Matthew Barley. And actually, we all met at more or less the same festival, Natalie and Matthew and me. And I find that both of them are very special musicians, but very different musicians. So for Natalie, she's a very sensitive player and a very expressive person as well. And Matthew is a very, 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 we say neugierig in Germany. In German, he wants to know everything. He's very curious. He's very, very vivid, and he's an improviser. He comes from a totally different style of playing and everything, and he's very much interested in rhythm and in jazz and all that. So maybe one can also hear this in the pieces.
And this sonata for solo cello for Natalie Klein, it's from 2007, but how does her character actually inhabit the piece? What is your starting point when you've met a musician and you're beginning to find out about them, and also the way they play, presumably?
Well, you know, it's not so much about her character. It's more about maybe, you know, giving me a clue why I want to this musician have to play my music. It's more about her playing, her tone, her expression, her presence on stage, all that. And I think that's most of the times very different from the character of a person. What you are on stage is not the same person which you are behind the stage. So it's more about the musician, Natalie Klein, than about the human being, Natalie.
And by giving it the title of sonata, you do seem to be quite deliberately placing yourself within a certain musical tradition.
Well, you know, I'm a bit fed up with all those titles. You know, every composer has to invent a very funny or cute or, I don't know, title. In those days, it has become a kind of a title mania. And so I really wanted to step back at one point from this. I also, of course, did this myself. And I think this is really a sonata because it's a three-movement piece. It's a piece with a clear tonal structure over the whole piece with one bow. It has got everything also of what we don't hear now, of something like a scherzo movement in the middle, and the slow movement is at the end. So it very much refers to a classical form of a sonata. So it's a sonata.
Well, we're going to start at the end of it, as it were,
yeah,
aren't we? So yeah. Maybe just give us some idea of what we've missed.
Oh,
before we hear the finale.
Well, the first movement you've missed pretty much the same as the last one. No, it starts off slowly and then, maybe the centerpiece is the second movement, which is a very rhythmically focused, fast and virtuoso movement. It's a combination of a scherzo on the one hand and of a tarantella at the other hand. And it's also that it refers to a piece which I've played with Natalie as well, which is the Messiaen Quatuor pour la fin du temps. And the rhythmical thinking of and methods of Messiaen are very close to my thinking. So I'm not the person who comes from jazz rhythms and you know, swing and time and and laid back and all that. But I'm much more coming from a motoric, precise rhythm with added with different meters and with different how should I say? Yeah, with different groups of threes and fours and fives and all that.
So that's how we get to the finale.
Yeah.
Where does it leave us?
Where do we end? Where do we end? We end at the finale, and that's also something I almost always have to do in my pieces. I have to create a great excitement and a climax in order to make silence possible at the end, or also inside a piece, you know. It's like if you are on a very, very busy street, and only when you close the door, then you close the door and you can hear the silence, or you even can more than hear it. You feel it's a body of silence standing here at once. And it's also, you know, you are in a room like this, and then you hear, for example, nothing, and then you turn off a loudspeaker or something, and then you hear the sound which was there before but isn't there anymore. So it's about those phenomena also. And everything what you can imagine with silence seems to be right. This can be from a very relieved atmosphere or feeling towards a really catastrophic feeling as well.
Well, to perform the third and last movement of Thomas Lacher's Sonata for Solo Cello, please welcome Frédéric Legrand.
Thank you.
The last movement of the Sonata for Solo Cello by Thomas Lacher, written for Natalie Klein in 2007, played for us by Frédéric Legrand, who'll be back on stage a little later for a performance of music from Kraken, Thomas Lacher's piano trio. Now, Thomas, you're from Innsbruck in Austria, but you studied in Vienna. So how much do you actually feel a part of Viennese and Austro-German tradition?
Well, I really don't feel as a part of it, but this may be wrong. Many people say that they feel some kind of Austrian sound in my music, and I don't know what I should think of it. I rather come from, well, musically even from minimalism, from other traditions, but not so much. I grew up with Bartok very much, but not so much with Schönberg and Berg, and only discovered those things later. And I'm still, well, I'm a great big skepticist about Schönberg. I mean, I've played many of his things, including his piano concerto, and especially this piece made me very skeptic about him, because it's, well, because of many things, it would be too take too long a time to. But mainly because he was such a guru, and I don't like that. Still, whenever I compose, many things I've heard in my youth come up to my mind and then come again. And so, it's as a matter of fact, of course, I grew up with Bach and Mozart and Schumann and Schubert, and maybe in a way this can be heard. And if you speak about tradition, I can also say that my music is, in a way, written for a very, so to say, normal situation, for normal classical concert situation where people are sitting in a hall listening, having concentration for, I don't know, some half an hour or some 20 minutes. So it's also has also got nothing to do with 4-hour Morton Feldman string quartets. So and in this way, of course, I stand in the tradition of classical music.
And when you were in Vienna, you, of course, as you said, you were also studying as a pianist while you were finding your voice as a composer as well. And
yeah.
It seems from a lot of your music and the way in which you work with piano and prepared piano particularly, as we hear in the double concerto and as yeah. we're about to hear, that the instrument affects the way you think about your music quite a lot. What are you doing when you prepare a piano? What are you trying to find inside the instrument?
Well, I don't think that at first I tried to find something, but I tried to escape something. You know, I tried to escape the piano sound, because I had the piano sound around me all the time, the normal piano sound, and I had been practicing, you know, all that crazy stuff. And I wanted to find a way of having the piano sound like it was my intention to sound. So the piano stood in the center of musical development, let's say, until 1930. For me, it has always been Bartok's second piano concerto, the last, and Reg 3, the last two real climaxes of great piano concerti, and where, you know, where the most advanced techniques of composition and instrumentation and combinations with the orchestra met with the real sound of the piano. Then the piano somehow took a sideway and musical development went somewhere else. And I discovered, as many composers of course do and did, I discovered a lot about the piano when recording for electronic music, when sampling sounds, trying inside the piano, trying to find sounds in the piano, to record them, prepare a tape or a live electronic thing or whatever. So this opened a way for me to be able to compose for piano at all.
And it takes us very much, that world of sampling takes us into the next piece we're going to hear, doesn't it? Which is the Antennen Requiem for H. Antennas,
yeah,
aerials,
right.
And a Requiem for H. Tell us something about the background to the piece.
Well, I've actually already done this. It is a very short piece in memory of a very dear friend of mine, a composer called Heimo Wisser, who was a highly inventive and inspiring musician for me. He died, I think, in 15 years ago, almost now. And it's in memory of him because I did a lot of the sampling stuff with him. And what you hear are just, you know, some strutchy, some little what's leftovers, you know, from his world, maybe.
And there's no score as such. There's a set of not quite instructions in German, and there's some apparatus. Yeah. You have the piano, you have two massage balls, these rubber balls with the spikes sticking out of them, some stones, large to small stones, some pieces of aluminium. Yeah. So how do you tell a performer what to do with them?
Well, it's just the system of Flaschenpost, which is not a song by Schubert, but a message in a bottle. And I just tell the people who want to play it on the phone, or I write them an email what to do and how to get this music done. And I like the idea of not having a score, you know, because it gives way to thinking and feeling and exploring the instrument and the sounds, and maybe also at some point something quite different will come out. I don't know.
And there's a sense of ritual about this Requiem, isn't there, which it maybe shares with the second movement of the new double concerto?
Yes, but this is really far more strange than in the double concerto. But you know, whenever you do something in the piano, normally people start to laugh, and it's just not about this in this piece. So you really have to perform it with conviction, otherwise it doesn't work. And if you are on stage and perform something with real conviction, you will simply get people really listen to the sounds coming out of this black animal. And I think when one really hears sounds like this for the first time, I think it's beautiful.
And I like the end of the instructions that I read for it. Es dauert so lange, wie es eben dauern soll, which is, it lasts as long as it needs to last.
Right, yeah. Which is always always a problem for the royalty companies, you know. How much should they pay me?
Well, let's hear the piece, and I'm really looking forward to this. To perform Antennen Requiem for H, prepared piano, and in this case, two musicians, pianist Petr Limonov from the Royal College of Music and the composer. was Antennas, Requiem for H, written in 1999 by Thomas Lacher. We just heard it performed live here at the Royal College of Music by the composer and pianist Petr Limonov. By the composer and the pianist, Petr Limonov. Now, a piece for prepared piano with no traditional piano technique involved at all.
Right.
And so a denial of the classical piano tradition in a way.
In a way, yes. Yeah. I don't touch a single key.
And where you write your music, I find interesting, because I know you have a very modern house in the mountains outside Innsbruck, and you must have some great views in many directions. Does that actually affect the way you compose, your place in the landscape there and the quality of that landscape?
Well, I wouldn't really say so. I can't see the house when I'm inside, so it doesn't affect me so much that it's looking great from outside. But what is true on the other side is that I get very many sounds from nature. As I already said, you know, when you are in silence or in a state of almost silence, when you are in the mountains, when you hear the sounds of nature, like the little rivers or the bells of the cows or the cracking of a tree in a wind, in a storm, when you experienced, you know, a lightning, when you are right in nature. I mean, these are just existential experiences for me, and they very much, I don't know, I mean, if you have a little river beside your house, it's almost the same sound as you are living just at a highway. It's not really much of a difference, but you feel it's so different. So it's also about that. It's about the contrast of urban life and rural life or nature, or what we call nature, what has been left over by us and what we call nature. As you heard, I mean, this is musique concrète, nothing more and nothing less. And sometimes it feels to me that a landscape can be music and nothing more and nothing less.
Now, we must find out something about the piece we're going to hear next, your piano trio, Kraken, because I think to quite a lot of British listeners, Kraken immediately brings up a myth of sea monsters or perhaps a novel by John Wyndham, but you say it's neither of those things.
No. I used to have little enigmas for my titles earlier on, and this is a very early piece, and Kraken is a town, is a part of a little town where I come from, and friends of mine are living there, and the piece is dedicated to them, so it seemed obvious to call it Kraken.
Now, you've said elsewhere that it's in some ways a reflection of your own compositional history.
Right, you know, there are five movements, and we'll hear two of them, and each movement more or less comes from a different stage of thinking and of development. And it starts with the solo violin movement, and then there is a piano violin movement, then there is the third movement we will hear, which is a movement with very many, one pattern just circling around itself. This is for a duo, more or less, for violin and cello, and some sounds from the piano added, also taken out from an endless circle of a pattern, coming to itself at the end again. And then there comes the fourth movement. This is the first movement to be played by all of the three players, really. So this is the build-up of the piece.
And it's constructed in layers of different ideas that you've tried at different times in your career as a composer. And I was just thinking, if this was finished in 1997, do you feel like adding something now, because you know, a lot has changed in your music, an orchestra, for example.
Yeah, no, not at all. No, I mean, this. I really was not so much a composer at that time. I overthought about composing, and I composed some little pieces, and I denied having developed a style. I didn't want to develop a style. I wanted to find a new world in every piece I wanted to find a real new thing, and it was very surprising for me that this piece then formed out as a real piece, because I think though it's very, the angles are quite wide, it's still, if you hear it as a whole, it somehow is really a piece, and that's nice, and it came about by chance, more or less.
And is this idea, though, that you question some of the ideas you've had as a composer and discard some of them, put some of them on one side as part of the process of writing this piece?
I'm afraid so, yes. Yeah.
And it's a trio, a piano trio, and yet there is also, there is another set of sounds, because we have a little preparation of the piano here as well. So
yes.
You do have effectively a fourth instrument, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, yes. And that's a major point in preparing the piano, because I always, coming from piano solo music, I always see that composers want to have many layers of sounds and rhythms within one piece, and it's always very hard for a player to make these really audible, you know, these layers, even in a Bach fugue or so. And so I simply muted some of the notes here, in order to be able to create a real distinctive second layer of sound, and to have in this case, not so much in this movement, but in the next movement, which we don't hear, that you really have another rhythmical layer than the rest of the piano, so to say.
So in that sense, it's actually closer to the way in which you use the prepared piano in the double concerto.
Right, yes.
Because that you have a separate set of instruments and set of sounds working as a concertino group at the back
there
of the orchestra.
There are some, percussion plays a big role in the new double concerto. So this means we have two orchestra percussions with wipes and mallets and all that stuff. And we have a concertino percussionist who is more an improviser than a percussionist in the ensemble, and who makes more sounds than really percussion work. But I on the piano do more percussion work in the double concerto, together with the soloists mainly.
Well, let's hear the third and fourth movements of Thomas Lacher's piano trio, Kraken. And to perform it, please welcome back to the stage pianist Petr Limonov, violinist Yuka Matsumoto, and cellist Frédéric Legrand.
Thank you. Thank you.